Hi, this is Kevin Clark. I'm senior editor and chief correspondent here at America Magazine, and I'm speaking today with David Courtwright. He's the director of policy studies at Notre Dame's Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, and that's what we'll be talking about today. If we've come any closer to world peace this week in New York, it's the ending of the 68th General Assembly at the United Nations, what we call in New York UN Week. Most New Yorkers are relieved to see the week end because it means the traffic snarls will be a little less horrible than they usually are. We've also seen a lot of work towards the goal of world peace with steps towards a peaceful resolution of some of the difficulties with Iran and a chemical weapons resolution passed by the Security Council on Syria. David, I wonder if we could start with that Syrian crisis. Is this cause for hope towards a more permanent resolution to this conflict in Syria?
Well, it's certainly an advance for addressing the chemical weapons issue, and in that sense, it's significant. It really is a milestone in trying to get control over chemical weapons. Syria was one of the major holdouts in the world. They have actually used these horrible things, and now if they've agreed to eliminate them, and so far the preliminary steps are positive, that's a tremendous success and really a sign of hope that maybe we can then get rid of all of the remaining chemical weapons and at least have one of the most horrible forms of weapons of mass destruction gone from the face of the earth. Whether that will actually help end the civil war itself is quite another matter. In principle, it could, because now you have the U.S. and Russia working together again. And remember, a few months ago, there was talk about a new conference, a Geneva II conference, they called it, to try to get the parties to sit around the table and see if they could reach an agreement on a ceasefire and some kind of political solution to the problems there. That's still a long way off. The rebels don't want to talk to Assad. The regime seems to be a little more willing to talk now, probably because the Russians are encouraging them. But it's still uncertain whether we're going to see an end to this horrible war.
And it seems like even more chaos is breaking out with some of the rebel factions going at it on top, and the Kurds themselves breaking away.
Actually, this is a multi-sided conflict. You've got at least a couple different sides battling each other. On the rebel side, you've got the government forces, and you've got the Kurds, and they all have different interests. I've always sympathized with the rebels, at least the original rebel movement, which was a nonviolent democracy movement. Remember that?
Yeah.
And they were horribly repressed by the regime. The war broke out. But now it's deteriorated to the point where the major element in the rebellion are the strong al-Qaeda forces, and they've been brutalizing people as badly, maybe even worse than the Assad regime. So it's hard to know what value could come from trying to support the rebels when there is so much division among them and there's forces within the rebel movement that we certainly would not want to encourage.
Is anyone even able to envision an end game to the Syrian civil war? I mean, what might a Syria that emerges from this, if there is any hope of a negotiated settlement, what might it look like?
Yeah, it's really hard, and I don't know that anyone's done any serious work on it because these forces are all intermingled. It's not like you could partition with one side might be over here or there. The Kurdish zone could somewhat be partitioned, but that's the last thing in the world that Turkey wants to hear about, or Iraq either, in terms of their Kurdish zone. But in terms of the rebel movements and the government forces, they're all mixed together. There's really no way one could partition. So somehow the people have to realize finally that this war has not brought any gain, that they're exhausted from it, the country is shattered, and there's got to be some understanding that of moving forward, trying to figure out some political accommodation. I mean, one of the things that's perhaps a sign of hope, Assad had said a couple of times that he would not stand for re-election in the scheduled elections if they occur next year, and that maybe there could be a more open political process. Maybe that's an opportunity for at least the democratic side of the rebel movement to participate in a more legitimate political process and perhaps gain some advantage in that way. But now you've got this element, as I say, of all the al-Qaeda-related extremist groups, and they're unlikely to be satisfied with any sort of electoral political process.
And we've already seen in this region how these kind of wars can just persist. I mean, how long did the Lebanese Civil War go on?
Yeah, it was like 15 years or more.
And it pretty much ended in a stalemate.
Right.
Without a partition, I guess, or maybe perhaps a de facto partition.
Right.
Now that, I guess, we can describe as a success because it's been more or less peaceful since the conclusion of that civil war.
But it's, at best, a very cold peace. It's certainly not anything that's going to be sustainable over the long term. And then if you look east, in terms of what's going on in Iraq, well, as the U.S. left, the civil war in the country diminished and more or less ended. But now it's revived and a terrible death toll. And it's a war between the Shia and the Sunni people. And it's causing tremendous loss of life now, almost as bad as it was back in 06.
And that's another situation where a dismantling of the national structure is not infeasible either, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. So we've come to a chemicals and weapons agreement that presumably will get the chemical weapons out of Syria. Is this a recognition then by most observers that it was the Syrian government that used the chemical weapons in August so brutally?
Well, from what we know in the public record, and especially the report from the UN inspection team, these attacks could only have been perpetrated by the organized forces of the Syrian government.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even reports showing the trajectory of the artillery shells, tracing it back to one of the military sites of the government. So we don't have absolute confirmation.
And they're still denying
highly likely.
It.
Highly likely.
Yeah, and the government is still denying that they were the origin of that attack.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we got to deal with the help of the Russians, and then Assad agreed to go along with it. Would this deal have happened without President Obama threatening a missile strike to diminish the military capability of the Syrian army?
Yeah, very important question. Well, there's no doubt that the threat of military attack quickened whatever interest there may have been in a diplomatic solution. Now, this particular idea that Russia might work with Syria to get its agreement on removing the nuclear weapons, that's been around for...
Chemical weapons.
The chemical weapons,
yeah.
Sorry. Yes, thank you.
We have enough troubles in Syria as it is.
Removing those weapons, that idea has been around for quite a while, at least a year, and has been discussed between the U.S. and Russia. But it wasn't going anywhere, and there's no doubt that when it looked like the U.S. was going to launch an attack with France participating, that pushed the diplomatic process forward, and I'm certain it motivated Putin and his Foreign Secretary Lavrov to take action and get the Syrians to agree to this deal.
Mm-hmm. But as a net positive for a more peaceful world, you're saying that this is one of the last holdouts on chemical weapons. What other mm-hmm. countries out there are using chemical weapons or maintaining chemical weapons capability?
Well, there's a few holding on to them, but no other states have actually used them, and almost all the countries of the world have agreed under the Chemical Weapons Convention to get rid of these weapons. The U.S. is still destroying the weapons we had. We started the process in the 90s. The Russians are doing the same. So overall, it's a very positive process for the world, make us safer from these deadly chemical weapons. And now with Syria joining in, it really makes the whole world safer, actually, from these weapons.
Now, another player in the region is also in the news this week because of UN Week, that's Iran. Rapprochement between the United States and Iran could actually be useful in resolving the Syrian crisis, correct?
Well, no doubt, and we could work not only with Russia, but also Iran, to try to convince the Assad regime to enter a negotiation with at least the more reasonable elements of the rebel movement. That does seem conceivable, but we still have to go a long way in getting some kind of a proper relationship with Iran. I mean, I think the president deserves credit for making that phone call to the Iranian president as he was leaving the country, getting on the freeway to go to Kennedy Airport. And so that's, I think, as far as I know, one of the first conversations of any kind between the leaders of U.S. and Iran for more than 30 years. So that's definitely a positive step. And the Iranians have been indicating that they have a real keen interest in trying to get a quick agreement on settling the differences over their nuclear program. And that will require them, though, to accept some limitations on their uranium enrichment and to allow much more transparency and more rigorous monitoring and inspection of their nuclear programs. But it'll also require on the U.S. that we need to give something as well, and it's obvious that we need to offer some sort of sanctions relief. And what I've been recommending is that there be a suspension, an initial suspension of some of the sanctions that we have on Iran. We've basically locked down their entire economy in terms of their oil exports, their banking system. So there's plenty of maneuver room that we have where we could begin to ease up on some of those measures, especially those that are affecting the ordinary people of Iran, that are making it more difficult for them to get access to medical equipment and the like. Ease up on some of those measures, offer a gesture of some sort of, a partial suspension of sanctions. We could do that really on our own, or we could do it in cooperation with the Iranians if they make a similar gesture. And that, I think, could be very significant in breaking the ice, allowing the negotiators to work out the details of some sort of more rigorous inspection and limitations on their nuclear program. Hopefully that could be achieved relatively quickly, and then it could lay the foundation for longer-term, tougher negotiations that will be necessary on a whole range of other issues. But we really need Iran's help. They could help us on the Syria question, as you just mentioned, but also in Afghanistan. I mean, we're going to be withdrawing our troops, most of them, next year. Afghanistan is still a mess. No one wants to see the Taliban come back into power, and the Iranians agree completely with us on that, and they have a lot of influence in Afghanistan. So it really would make a lot of sense for us to try to work with Iran now, as we did, by the way, back in 01 when we overthrew the Taliban government, work with them to help the Afghani people come up with a government that is representative of the people but that keeps the Taliban out of power.
And presumably they have some influence in conditions in Iraq as well.
Yes, indeed. And it could help settle the conflict there. So there's a lot of ways in which we can work with them.
What do you make of this new president, Hassan Rouhani, if I'm saying his name properly?
Yeah. Well, I think he's the real deal. I mean, the fact that he was elected with 50% of the vote, so he avoided a runoff, and he was the most pro-reform of the candidates, and went against the candidates who had been favored by the Ayatollahs, by the religious authorities, and that he came out on top, and then also that he campaigned on two major platforms. One was he wanted to normalize and improve relations with the West, with the rest of the world, because Iran has been very isolated recently. And secondly, he wanted to improve the economy. And of course, those two things are interrelated. Iran will not get relief from the sanctions unless it's willing to cut a deal on the nuclear program. And so I think he's got a strong self-interest. The Iranian people and government, they need to get these sanctions lifted. We could offer, partial lifting of sanctions and use that as leverage to get the Iranians to then move towards more rigorous controls and inspection of their nuclear program.
And he's got a very delicate job as president. We've seen evidence of that. I mean, every conciliatory gesture he made while he was here in New York, he almost had to backstep each time because of the sort of outrage it generated at home. In fact, the near handshake with Obama and the phone call was welcomed with some tweets from on his Twitter account that were quickly deleted. And when he got home, he was pelted with eggs by some hardliners in Tehran.
Yeah. Well, Iranian public opinion is divided on this. I mean, he was cheered also at the airport, so he had supporters and opponents. And this is something we need to be aware of. I mean, we should be encouraging Rouhani. We're not going to get a better, more reform-oriented leader out of Iran. I mean, let's face it. Most of them are very rigid, very conservative. Look at the last guy, Ahmadinejad. Mm-hmm. So if you have someone who's slightly better and a reform-oriented person, make a deal with him while you can.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of, Gorbachev. I mean, is Rouhani an Iranian Gorbachev? And when Gorbachev first came on, people in Washington were skeptical, including President Reagan. But Reagan quickly turned on to Gorbachev, and they had a first summit meeting, and they began to develop a relationship. And I think Reagan's great achievement in trying to end the Cold War was because he recognized that he could cut a deal
with Gorbachev.
So we should do the same now with Rouhani.
We've seen already, though, how tricky this kind of movement towards a detente or a rapprochement or a normalization of relations can be between Iran and the United States. There's already a great deal of pushback in Washington and apparently in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem about how quickly this friendship seems to be blossoming between Presidents Obama and Rouhani.
Well, I call it the Iran bashing movement in the U.S. or coalition. But, yeah, you have members of Congress, you have the sort of right-wing pro-Israeli lobby groups, and they're frightened by the prospect of an agreement. It really makes no sense because, frankly, it's absolutely in Israel's self-interest that the Iranian nuclear program be put under controls and have more transparency. I mean, why would they be opposed to that? So,
is it their own nuclear program being part of the package that worries them?
That's part of it. I mean, you heard Rouhani say that, you know, if there is to be a nuclear agreement, they would like to see a nuclear weapons-free zone in the entire region.
They don't mean our nuclear weapons.
Right. Well, I think they do, actually, in terms of what's out there on the ships and the like. And we may have seen also at the UN week that the Egyptian government once again raised the demand that it has raised in the past at the UN to achieve a zone free of nuclear weapons throughout the region. So
that would probably be better for the region in the sense that, you know, if Iran goes any further with its program, whether or not it ever acknowledges it as a program, that would encourage the Saudis to consider a program, the Egyptians to consider a program.
Yeah, total mess, yeah.
Yeah.
And if we've gotten to a point now where chemical weapons are out of the region, you know, it makes logical sense to now consider getting the nuclear weapons out of the region. That'll be more difficult, certainly. Israel's not going to get rid of its nuclear weapons till it feels more secure, not only with Iran, but also with the Palestinians and other neighboring countries. But nonetheless, an agreement between the U.S. and Iran to settle this nuclear issue, to get the Iranian program under tighter control and more transparency, that would be huge. And it would improve security throughout the region, and it could be a step towards, as I say, a number of other agreements or processes that could settle some of the conflicts in the region.
Well, let's put this all before Pope Paul in 1965, on October 4th, when he urged the UN to fulfill its mission to adapt to changing times and historical changes, and keep its eye focused on peacemaking and never more war. Do you think Pope Paul would be pleased by what happened this week in New York?
Yeah, I think he's smiling up there. It was a good week for the UN. It was a good week for the possibilities of diplomacy and peacemaking. Tiny steps, yes, but steps in the right direction.
Okay, on that note, I think we can wrap up our chat here this afternoon with Professor David Courtwright of the Kroc Institute at Notre Dame University. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Courtwright.
Okay, thank you, Kevin.
And thank you for joining us here at AmericaMagazine.org.